You're listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast with your hosts, Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to this week's Soccer Report Extra podcast, a podcast that doesn't take the summer off. This week, we take stock of the Gold Cup, considering Aston Villa's hunt for a new manager, pontificate on the UEFA qualifying pots for World Cup 2014, check in on the opening games at UEFA's under-21s, and question, is it really under-21s? And finish up with a look at MLS as the first team hits a halfway mark of the regular season. Owen, let's start with the Gold Cup. First of all, the big story from last week, Mexico's drug issue. They lost five players through suspension. Substance that was involved was, I believe it's clenbuterol. It was described as by the Mexican Federation as an accident, and suggested the drug, which is used to treat breathing disorders, was in fact tainted meat the players ate during training camp. Unfortunately, where the story begins to sort of look a little bit suspect is the fact that other players ate the same meat, or appeared to, and didn't test positive for the substance. The Federation president said there was no, I quote him, there is no negligence here. We are very strict ourselves. We are one of the few federations that conduct these tests before entering a competition. We are open here. We are transparent. Just before we get into this, I just want to kind of put this in some sort of context as well. Is that's a little bit disingenuous, the comment about we are one of the few federations that conduct these tests before entering a competition. The US, let's say some of the US Olympic teams always test their athletes before competitions as well. Mm. And there's a reason for that. And a number of countries do that as well because they don't want to get caught.
Yeah.
So to say that that's actually a positive is maybe not exactly true. But tainted meat, could it be?
It could be.
I guess we're putting you in the position as our drug
well,
drug authority.
I've been called other things, as well as a drug expert, pharmaceutical expert, perhaps would be a little bit better way to put it. Similarities with this and Contador at last year's Tour de France, because he tested positive for clenbuterol as well.
Yeah.
And he said, listen, I just ate the wrong food substance. It was contaminated. And ultimately, he appealed successfully and his suspension was overturned. What's a little bit unusual about this case is that there's so many of them who tested positive. You know, if it's a, for instance, if it is a doping offence, you could excuse one guy who's just been stupid about it.
But when five of them being stupid.
And six, because one of them had already been sent home with an injury or with some sort of complaint. Yeah. Urinary tract infection, I do believe it was, which is kind of ironic, given the fact that he later tested positive for a banned substance. Anyway, but the likes of Guillermo Ochoa that you lose, as well as Rodriguez, who started...
Yeah, big centre-half.
Yeah.
Centre-back.
It's worrying. Now, it could have been a lot worse. For instance, if it was tainted meat, Hernandez, Guardado... you go through him, Gio Dos Santos, mm-hmm. Marquez, you could have lost. It's an unusual story. Like, Mexico have been very forceful in debating the merits of essentially being overshadowed by a drug row and doping case and a scandal, and they want to distance themselves from that. But as you said, I mean, if you test your players properly and you make sure that this stuff doesn't happen, well then, you know, you're well able to take care of your own house. But... this is an embarrassment, and it could potentially lead to costing Mexico a Gold Cup here.
Well, it could also certainly cost them some players for the World Cup qualifying.
Yeah,
because they could be looking between 6 months and 2 years suspension. World Cup qualifying should start by the end of the year in CONCACAF.
Yeah.
So a number of these players would be banned for World Cup qualifying if found guilty.
It's just an unusual story. I mean, you look at... there was a couple of months ago, I think it was back in April, there was a German... doping agency who warned of the perils of potentially inadvertently in Mexico eating certain types of food and it being contaminated. So they essentially warned international athletes to just be, you know, be safe in the knowledge that this could harm them potentially. So it just looks maybe as if the Mexicans have lost the run themselves a little bit.
But there's also the issue if this happened at their national training centre, you would have thought the national training centre would have some sort of vetting process for the food coming in to begin with.
And also be aware of the perils or likely perils of contamination.
So I think I'm really cynical on this one because of personal experience. Because I was back to the 99 Pan American Games, Javier Sotomayor, the Cuban high jumper, test positive for cocaine in Winnipeg.
Wow.
And I was...
Was that contaminated?
That's the story I'm going to get to, because I was quite close to this at the time and that's the work I was doing. And it was cocaine he was found guilty of. And the Cubans claimed that his food had been contaminated, had been sabotaged.
I know the portage in Maine can be a little bit dodgy at times.
But it sounds quite plausible. You know, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you could say, oh, just a minute, maybe they're out to get him.
And cocaine is not a doping offence that you go, well, that's performance enhancing.
It's a bit stimulant. So that was it. But the thing is, where he stayed in the village, it was smorgasbord kind of meals. So basically, to be able to sabotage his meal, we would have to find his pork chop and sprinkle the cocaine on his pork chop or whatever it was he was eating. So I think just the history of the doping offence, we've had so many explanations and so many excuses and so many reasons to put forward as why, you know, these were not intentional doping infractions. I've just, over the years, you look at them, 99% of them really turn out to be just ways of trying to cover up.
The good thing for Mexico is that this story hasn't really caused them too much bother on the pitch.
No.
Because they're safely through to the quarterfinals now. And
scintillating display against Costa Rica.
Yes.
4 goals there, 5 goals against Cuba, 5 goals against El Salvador.
Hernandez, top scorer in the tournament, but although he didn't score against Costa Rica, which a game which ended in 4-1 win for the Mexicans. And that game, inadvertently, could prove to be very important for Canada.
Yeah,
because of the race for the two best third place teams.
Yeah, here's a summary just for the listeners. We're recording this on Monday, so Guatemala versus Grenada, I should say. God, I'm getting the mispronunciations.
You're gonna
the commentators offender, now. Yes, Grenada, Honduras against fans. Jamaica. Now El Salvador finished third in Group A, and with the two best third place finishers going through, I guess El Salvador is the bar at the moment. So they have 4 points. So you've got to, if you're looking to go through, you've got to match the 4 points and you've got to beat their -1 because they beat Cuba 6-1. They scored even more goals against Cuba than Costa Rica and Mexico did. So they're a -1. So I guess that's a bar. You've got to reach 4 points and you've got to get better than -1. Now, the thing going for El Salvador in this is that they have scored 7 goals.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a little bit of an advantage because if it becomes a tiebreaker on points, tiebreaker on goal difference, it would then go to goals scored. So if you look at Group B, Guatemala play tonight. They've got... Guatemala had really need a 2-0 win because if they win 1-0, they will not... they will match the goal difference, but they will not go match the goals scored. So Grenada had a bit of a pummeling so far. And then another Honduras, Jamaica. Well, Honduras are sitting there with a goal difference of 6 at the moment. So even if Honduras lost, you don't think they're going to.
No.
So it's really, if you're the States and Canada, if you're supporting the United States or Canada, you're looking at Guatemala tonight and you're keeping an eye on them. And then you get into the last Group C, last games from Group C on Tuesday, which would be Canada versus Panama. Panama with a surprise win in some quarters, and USA and Guadeloupe. So it looks very much like with the goal difference that the United States have, that in fact a draw would be sufficient for the United States to go through.
Yeah, and what's a little bit of a peril for Canada is that really a win could solve a lot of their problems, but they're playing a team that are already through and have got 2 wins under their belt from 2 games and coming off a 2-1 success over the United States. So essentially what's a little bit of a liability for the Canadians is that in contrast to the other teams in that best third place slot, they have to face the best team in their group when the other two have easier assignments to deal with.
Yeah, if Guatemala do win 2-0 this evening, 2-0 or better, then that would take Guatemala to break even on goal difference and they'd have the 4 points. So they would definitely go through and then it would come down to El Salvador or Canada if Canada drew. And that's where it gets kind of tricky because then once again we're back to this situation with goals scored and Canada would not look good in that because I really can't see them having a 6-6 draw.
The thing that springs instantly to mind is Canada's game against Guadeloupe.
Yep, 1-0. Playing against 10 men for a long period.
And needed a Duende Rosario penalty in order to secure 3 points. This is, from my perspective, I haven't seen much internationally of Canada. So, you know, I wasn't really too sure of what to expect, how they'd approach the game. Obviously, going from a 2-0 defeat to the US, you looked at it as a derby game as such. Canada did look a little bit flat. But late on, they did cause a few problems for Bob Bradley's team. This time around, my word, it was...
uninspired?
It was just... they went a goal up. And this is why I had an issue with the performance. We've just touched on how important goal difference and goals scored can be in this tournament. You're dealing with three groups. You're dealing with essentially mathematics come the quarterfinal stage and qualification for the knockout stages. And Canada,
Just one more goal.
Just one more goal.
We didn't know what the outcome of the El Salvador result was going to be, but you'd think 2-0. Get some even at least.
Get as much as you can. And the thing was that Guadeloupe, in fairness to them, you've seen it so often, teams with 10 men and they just get 9 men behind the ball and they're just happy to probably try to get you on the counter-attack and maybe nick something. Guadeloupe were attacking down the flanks, loads of space in central midfield. So every time Canada did intercept in their own back line and turned, so much space available for them, so much time on the ball. And they'd reach the edge of the box. And we were seeing on TV players that would get open. And we were shouting at the television, leave it go. He's wide. Knock it wide. There's an extra touch. Turns back onto midfield. Has a look. Who's their safe option all the time? Really cagey. No cutting edge. And ultimately, you know, they held. But it could very well now have proven to have cost them a place in the quarterfinals. It was a very, very strange situation to have been in.
Watching them against the United States and watching a good part of the game against Guadeloupe, but the one thing that struck me about Canada over the two games is there's actually been, I think, some quite good individual performances. Josh Simpson's caused some problems on that left side. But there's a little bit of flattering to deceive as well because there doesn't seem to be any end result. So you'll go past a couple of players and then there won't be really a telling ball played into the penalty box or a shot set up.
It
seems to be these spotted kind of individual performance. It goes back to this comment I made last week about a very disjointed performance, and I think I continue with that. Is there's these individual kind of beacons of light, but they seem to be an unbalanced team at the moment, and they don't seem to have worked out how to get the best out of these individual performances within some sort of team concept.
It's interesting you should say that, because when I was watching it, I made a comment in the office to a couple of the guys. It said, I just said to them, it looks as if these Canadian players haven't played with each other before. Yeah. It's that, you know, you're not sure what your teammates can do, so you're reluctant to push them just in case they don't kind of step up to the level. You know, they brought Simeon Jackson on, had him wide right, a little bit of pace, great, some you know, isolate him with the fullback, let's get him going. And it just again, flat. Yeah. There was no,
the
there
one
was no
shot
sense of pushing.
That was it.
And it was, you know, he came on, has the shot, and you're thinking, great, well, let's push that. You've got a situation there that's obviously a clear advantage for you. Let's go and let's work with it. And they didn't. Yeah. And you looked at, you know, particularly their midfield, which you look at De Guzman, De Rosario, you've got Will Johnson there as well. You've got Dunfield from Vancouver. Solid, you know, at least 4 and possibly even 5 with Simeon Jackson playing wide as well. It's a good base to work from. But again, it just seems to be plenty of perspiration, but just no inspiration.
Oh, maybe the good news of the prospects for them is if they are finding a little bit difficult to get used to each other, if they can get through the group stage, maybe they begin to find that cohesion once the knockout stage comes. Well, next week at this time, we'll know where Canada got to, whether they're qualified. Same with the United States. I know that one of the topics we're going to have to touch in the next couple of weeks is Bob Bradley. So we're not forgetting about Bob Bradley, we're not forgetting about the US, but we'll get back to that in a future podcast. And next to the Premier League managerial merry-go-round, Mark Hughes was linked with a Villa job after resigning his post at Fulham. Villa's attention, however, fell on Roberto Martinez from Wigan. But he gave them a big thanks, but no thanks, which I think surprised an awful lot of people. Certainly surprised the press.
Yeah.
Although David Whelan had indicated he felt that Martinez was going to stick with it. So maybe Whelan's comment about sticking with Martinez when things were tough during the season actually paid off. I'll throw one into you. I think I know where Martinez is going to finish up. Emirates.
You think so?
Yep.
Give I it, can see that happening.
Give it a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I think Martinez might well be the heir apparent to Wenger at Emirates.
Hopefully he's slightly better in transfer department than Mr. Wenger has shown.
Anyway, so then we move on to Alex McLeish, formerly of the Premier League Manor.
Yes.
Who had been turfed out after his lease expired. Birmingham City boss. Sorry, former.
Former. Lots of formers, yes, going on with Alex McLeish these days.
Former Birmingham City boss resigned over the weekend, and immediately it was speculation tied him to a Aston Villa approach. How realistic is that, Owen?
What I would say to listeners is traditionally, this time of the year is when English football journalists go on holiday, usually for 2 weeks. Those who are not so fortunate have to remain at their desks
and do double shifts
with their editors behind them saying, we need 500 words on who the next manager Aston Villa is going to be. So you have plenty of rumour, even in respected publications. You'll have stories that you come across and you're going, that sounds too good to be true. Chances are it is. So that's one word of advice that we give to listeners. This McLeish story is interesting. Firstly, it's been an acrimonious resignation from Birmingham. He emailed Peter Panu when Panu was out of
business. I believe the first one bounced back.
peter.panu@gmail.com. Oh, no,
oh,
sorry.
Oh, sorry, forgot the P.
Sorry, it's the other Peter. But, oh, sorry. peterpan@gmail.com. Anyway.
Come on, Tinkerbell. Keep on going.
So the resignation has been rejected by Birmingham. What Panu has said is that McLeish's behaviour has been irresponsible, just sending him an email saying, yeah, you know what, I don't really fancy going back to St Andrews.
Alex McLeish's response was, well, I thought I was going to Twitter him. I was going to send a tweet
at Peter Panu, I'm resigning. Sorry about that. Best of luck with your role replacement.
Disgusted.
Yeah, with a sad face.
Yeah.
LOL. So... McLeish being linked with Aston Villa makes perfect sense.
Sorry, I'm just waiting for the Opta stats to come out this afternoon. 3, number of managers resigned by email.
Yeah, and the little word electronic.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going slightly off topic.
Sorry, yeah.
McLeish is now being linked with the Villa job. He was previously linked with Villa before they brought Julia in. Last September.
Well, that's true. Yes. Yeah, I remember that one.
But what you have to remember is, firstly, it's an acrimonious departure from Birmingham.
Yes.
So your fans are already probably a little bit peeved that you've walked out of them.
And pissed off.
Yeah, and pissed off. Secondly, they would probably not like it for you to walk across the road to your nearest and dearest rivals.
Particularly because the team that you're leaving has just been relegated.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're forgetting all about the Carling Cup win by this time because relegation is top of mind.
Yeah, and they've lost so many players that, I mean, Birmingham supporters are now looking at the club. I actually know a Birmingham supporter who on his Facebook page, when they were relegated, said, I've had enough of Brom, I'm now supporting Villa. Don't care what you say, I'm off to support Villa. So see you, lads. Thanks for absolutely nothing. Carling Cup, yeah, whatever. We've been relegated again, so I'd like to say cheerio, lads.
Wasn't somebody called Alex, was it?
No, it wasn't, actually. Anyway, it could have been. Maybe he is an alias. Hang on. The wheels are turning in my head now. Anyway,
conspiracy theories.
It's hard to believe that he'll walk to Villa. You could kind of imagine that Villa fans would appreciate Martinez coming to their club. Young, energetic, vibrant, great relationship with his players.
Not English.
Not English. McLeish, he doesn't really fill you with optimism, does he? You know, he's been relegated twice at Birmingham, doesn't have a great track record with, making great signings.
Has won a trophy.
He has won a trophy. He has got European qualification.
Yes, he has.
I'm not sure if I was a Villa supporter, how much I'd be looking forward to these rumours linking McLeish with a move to Villa.
I just don't know. I don't know how you sell it. I really don't.
An interesting article that I was reading earlier today, Graham Taylor being quoted, and Graham Taylor is a very, very intelligent guy.
Yes, he is.
And we like to pay him particular attention. Knows Aston Villa obviously incredibly well, mm-hmm. having 2 stints there as manager. But he was just saying that he was just disappointed with Villa's approach to finding a new manager. He was talking about how when Julia got ill again, surely your mind should start turning to
should have been start turning before that.
Yeah, exactly. And even Julia's appointment in the first place, I thought was prehistoric. It's just really, really just out of touch.
If you go back, when was that appointment? That appointment was September, August yeah. last year. If you go back to the website, I wrote an article about McAllister and Julia's appointment, the two of them, and saying that McAllister was probably the most critical one because of Hooley's, one of the reasons, main reason being Hooley's health.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at bringing two people together. Surely if you want to do that seamlessly, the second in command should be somebody that you're looking at saying, if Hooley goes down again, if there's a problem with his health, we should have, this should be seamless. We should have enough faith to say the number two is the guy stepping up.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, in its essence, they're not looking at McAllister, makes the Hooley appointment and the McAllister appointment flawed to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It was not thought through.
Well, it's interesting because we're looking at a pattern here where, be it Paul Faulkner, be it Randy Lerner, there's very little example of a plan B being in place mm-hmm. throughout this whole period yeah. in the club.
Because Martinez, Bales.
It seems to be, and again, yeah. it comes back okay, to something that Taylor said. It's a kind of fly by the seat of your pants.
Yeah.
Whoever's available, you get linked to him.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem
Mind
to be...
you, that could be the media as well.
Yeah,
but they're not controlling the media.
No.
Because if they were putting more control around their messaging, they'd be coming out saying, we've identified three people we're going to interview.
Yeah.
Da, da, da. You speculate all you want, but we know who our three guys are.
And also, I mean, if you
but
do...
it's a vacuum just now.
Yeah, and if you do pay attention to reliable sources within the media, of which there are many... BBC, their correspondent, who has been following this story quite intimately, you know, was mentioning how Lerner was close to bringing Steve McLaren in for an interview. But when he felt the hatred from the fans and feared the backlash, he just totally backed away.
Yeah.
Now, supporters, very, very important to a club, of course, but they don't rule the club. Now, I mean, for McLaren to be, he's obviously been appointed as Forest boss, to be in a position where he can't even get an interview for an Aston Villa job because of what happened at a national level with England, that is disgraceful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Steve McLaren is not a championship manager. That is
no,
what
he's
let's
not.
Get that thing.
That, the
let's
Forest link is bizarre.
It's incredible. The thing was, what I said to you before coming into the podcast, I genuinely fear that McLaren's taken that job because he could not get any other job
yeah.
that's going in the top flight.
Yeah.
Now, you look at some of the weak links in managerial positions in the Premier League. You're telling me that Steve McLaren can't do a better job?
Yeah.
He's had, you know, an indifferent time on the continent.
But he did a job in Middlesbrough.
At least we not forget that, you know, how successful he was before he made it step up to, yeah. to that England job, which is a poison chalice.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but if Fabio Capello, who is looked upon as being a pioneer and an incredibly successful manager at club level, if he struggles with this bunch of incompetence... well, then I think everyone's going to struggle. So, I mean, the McLaren thing, I just think it's this symptom of a wider ill within the English game. It's just a disgusting sort of attack on this guy who, has he done much wrong than stand on a touchline with an umbrella
yeah.
handing over his head?
Went to Holland, won a league championship. How many English managers have won a league championship?
Yeah, and I think that this Villa saga, pre-season training starts back on 7th of July. Now,
not long.
Yeah, it's not long. And, you know, you go in there, Ashley Young looks set to finalise his move to United. You're going to have to struggle to keep hold of Downing. You also have to kind of quell this disquiet in the dressing room. Collins and Dunn.
They need some leadership. They desperately need some leadership from a coach who's going to go in and say, look, this is how it's going to be. If you're upset, you can go now. If you don't, you're with us. You're sticking with it. Put your head down, start working.
And the thing is that a coach that you need in that situation is a guy who communicates very, very well with his playing staff. One guy who communicates incredibly well with his playing staff, has a proven record of doing so, is Steve McLaren.
Yeah.
I just read a comment from Mark Crossley, who played under McLaren
yep,
at Middlesbrough, who was
keeper.
On his Twitter page just saying, listen, I can't believe that McLaren has signed for Forest. What an amazing achievement. He's a terrific manager. As if McLaren has to prove himself all over again. Because ultimately, if you've got a guy like Mark Hughes, who was linked with the Villa job, he doesn't really exactly have an apparent cosy relationship with his players.
Yeah.
There seems to be a little bit of a frosty, on occasion, frosty sort of a relationship.
The Mark Hughes speculation wasn't embraced by the Villa fans either, was it?
Well, and apparently Randy Lerner didn't appreciate the way that Hughes just walked out in Fulham.
Yeah.
Now, they've obviously lost out on Yall as well, who's gone to Fulham to replace Hughes. So you look around and the landscape at managerial level in the Premier League, Villa don't seem to have too many options. I mean, if McLeish is the best, these guys like Chris Hughton still knocking around. He's a decent young coach, but it's not. Now, surely you'd have to look at next season, Villa doing a lot better than they did in the last campaign. But it's not an easy job to walk into. You know, it's a side who, again, we have to remember that had three consecutive sixth place finishes.
Oh, Martin O'Neill set that bar. Maybe not so much a bar as a glass ceiling he set, because. Yeah. It was very difficult to see them pushing on from that, but that's what Hooley inherited, and any future manager will inherit as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's the aspiration for them. I mean, yeah, I remember you go back to even when I was closely following the game, you know, at an early age, mid-90s with Atkinson. They almost won the league in 93.
Yeah, looking very close.
94, Coca-Cola Cup, 60, 96, another Coca-Cola Cup. And then, obviously, he was the kind of next generation with O'Neill. So,
Sold Dwight York.
That was the end of it, you know. But whoever comes in next, got a little bit of a job to get him back on that kind of top six level.
Last week, UEFA announced their pots for the 2014 World Cup qualifying. We're going to look at who you think might be the easiest qualifying group as far as pot one country is concerned. So essentially what I'm asking you for are the easiest opponents from pots two through six. And let's look at who we've got. There's a little bit of uncertainty, because my understanding is they've announced these pots as they stand just now, but they're subject to final FIFA rankings for July that will come out in July. So there might be some changes. But as they stand just now, very quickly, pot one, Spain, Netherlands, Germany, England, Portugal, Italy, Croatia, Norway, Greece. Pot two, who is, you'd term, the weakest teams out of pot two, which is made up of Serbia, Slovenia, Russia, France, Montenegro, who came very close to getting into pot one, Switzerland, Slovakia, Denmark and Sweden.
The weakest links I've gone for here, Denmark, the Slovaks and Switzerland. And I just kind of base that on essentially Euro qualifying, to be perfectly honest. You know, it's kind of the same transition, same jump that you'd use.
I'd be looking at Slovenia and I think Montenegro. And the only reason I go for Montenegro is I think they're on a great run just now, but can they hold it? Can they keep that consistency from tournament to tournament? Or do they maybe do well in Euro qualifying and rest on their laurels a little bit and find themselves fading back? So anyway, that's group two. So Owen's going for Switzerland, Slovakia, Denmark being perhaps the easier touches in pot two. Pot three, Turkey, Czech Republic, Israel, Ireland, Ukraine, Belgium, Romania, Bosnia-Herzegovina and Bulgaria.
Three weakest teams here for me: Bulgaria, Romania and the Czech Republic.
Ooh, think they're aging a bit?
I think that, you know, there was a golden generation for a while.
Yeah, there was.
You had the likes of Kolar, Poborski, Nedved. And it's just kind of, you know, it'll take them time to recapture that sort of talent pool.
Yeah, my one is, and this one is Bulgaria. I think they're the soft touch out of pot three. Pot four, Lithuania, Albania, Hungary, Belarus, Georgia, Armenia, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Poland.
Unfortunately, no offence to your homeland, of course. Scotland for me.
The weak.
They join European heavyweights, Lithuania and Poland.
You're cruel. I've got actually Poland is ranked as one of the tougher ones here.
Really?
Yeah, I'll go for Armenia
as being one of the weak links.
Weak links, especially away from home. Maybe a little bit tough in Armenia, but I think away from home that shouldn't be too difficult. Pot five: Austria, Estonia, Latvia, Finland, Macedonia, Moldova, Cyprus, Azerbaijan, and Wales.
Lots of household names,
even in their own house.
I've gone for Gary Speed's Wales
as being the weaker.
As being one of the weakest, along with Latvia and Cyprus.
Ooh. Cyprus seemed to be coming on a decent run of form a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
it seemed to fade again.
That trip to Nicosia was one of the things that you saw it on a fixture, just going, oh, it's going to
You know the worst thing they did? Grow grass. Remember Scotland going there? I think Richard Gough bailed them out with a 3-2 win some years ago.
That.
And you looked at the park and you said, where's the grass?
Yeah.
There was no grass.
Is this Eric Cantona's beach football?
It was a big. You saw little slithers of grass up the sidelines.
The guy's painting the green onto the pitch.
Oh, it's a terrible state. But then they put down all grass and it seems to affect Cyprus's form. Now, the pot six.
This is the one we're waiting for,
this
really.
Is the one. Drum roll. Iceland, Luxembourg, Faroe Islands, Kazakhstan, Liechtenstein, Malta, Andorra, and who could forget San Marino?
Well, San Marino nil. You know, I think it's 33 goals they've conceded in Euro qualifying so far. So they're an instant favourites here as one of the weaker sides in pot number six, along with Andorra. And I've gone for Luxembourg as well. I've decided to lay off Liechtenstein after their recent win in the Euro.
They're on a run. They're on a run.
This is their greatest. Yeah. This is the greatest run in the history of the country, I think. Apart from that time when they drew 0-0 with Jack Charlton's Republic of Ireland side back in 1985.
You know what Liechtenstein's famous for?
Mario Frick, that striker who's is he still playing?
He's still playing. Yeah, yeah.
No, they're 40.
They actually are the largest fan manufacturers in the world of false teeth.
There you go.
You were speechless there, weren't you?
I was. Yeah. I didn't have any comeback.
You would think they would be able to take a bite out of the opposition.
Hey! And we should have, before that, Lou, can we just get a kind of Bobby's useless fact of the day as a kind of a jingle?
I remember that, though. That actually comes from The Guardian. It was when England were playing Liechtenstein a few years ago. The guy started the minute by minute that fact.
I do remember that Ireland game when we drew 0-0 with Liechtenstein on their pitch, in inverted commas. The dugouts
on the hillside
looked like bus stops.
No, that'd be the word,
bus stops. And I think if memory serves me right, they were just like fold out chairs along the touchline. Now that was 95.
Did
so
you have to bring your own?
Probably. You know what I mean? But yeah, that was. I hope that Liechtenstein have kind of moved on and become more progressive.
Since. So the heavy hitters out of pot one. If you're looking at making this the easiest possible. We've listed off some of the easier, what you'd consider the easier teams in each of these pots, but who are the heavy hitters that would be just absolutely overjoyed? We're looking at Spain, Netherlands, Germany, England, Portugal, Italy, Croatia, Norway, and Greece.
Obviously, you look at Spain, firstly, as reigning world champions, European champions, take them. But also, you look at the guys who are always so ridiculously good in qualifying, which are Germany and Holland.
Yeah,
and once they're in a group, they've very
Netherlands have got their mojo back, didn't they?
Yeah, they
struggled
just
in 2002 when Roy Keane was in his heyday.
Jason McAteer with the winner for the Republic at Lansdowne Road. But at least we forget people out there.
Yeah, but since then Euro qualifying, World qualifying, they do have their rhythm back, and they're an awesome sight when they get moving.
Mm.
So okay, so that's the top team. So let's flip this around and let's look at who the most difficult teams might be from the pot. So let's start in reverse. Pot one, who do you look at as being the weak sisters?
In pot one, the three teams that you look at straight away as being slightly unusual that they're actually in there at all, Croatia, Norway, and Greece.
Mm-hmm.
As top seeds go, if you're, as you pointed out, a third or fourth place team who may fancy taking a scalp or two and you're drawn in the same group as Croatia, Norway, or Greece, That's a decent draw that you can get.
I can kind of see the Croatia one to some extent, although I don't think they're the kind of strong team that we saw a few years back.
Yeah, finished third at World Cup 98.
Yeah, and then into Euros, you know, the qualifying for Euros, qualifying for World Cups. But Norway and Greece, I think you look at it and go, just a minute, you know, you fancy your chances there.
They just look as if they've lost their way a little bit. Yeah, they're in the top seed. Well,
it's like the Montenegro one.
Yeah.
Pot two, Montenegro coming so close to actually being pot one. If Montenegro, apparently, I read that if Montenegro had beaten Bulgaria, they would have been a pot one team, which is part of the problem when you go on current rankings and don't do some, you know, you get so many people every, just use the current rankings, the current rankings. Well, they've used them this time and maybe it doesn't work out quite so well.
And it feeds into why pot two is quite problematic for teams here.
That's right, because you look at we've been through pot two, but this what would you look at as being the strong suit of pot two?
I've gone for France, the one team that jumps straight out at you. I mean, you're looking at a potential setup where you have a heavyweight from pot one and then a France in pot two. I mean, that's just not nice at all. But I've also gone for Russia and Serbia. One thing that jumps out at you at pot two is how many Eastern European teams there are to contend with.
Yep.
I think the Russians just traditionally, they're having a little bit of trouble with the Euro qualifying. But
maybe getting a bit aged as well.
A little
aged.
Bit. But I just think that, they're kind of cold-blooded, kind of assassin types. Yeah. And they're always in with a shout. And Serbia as well, who I think that, again, they're not having the greatest campaign at the moment, but you look back to World Cup qualifying for 2010, were very, very impressive. And they've got a good base in that squad as well.
And certainly, if you saw Norway getting pulled out of a hat with France and asked people what who they thought the pot one team would be, you'd think it would be France.
Mm.
So on to pot three, the strengths in pot three, you're allowed to say Ireland.
Well, I just look at Ireland as people go, oh, you're obviously biased. And yes, I am.
Yeah.
and make no qualms about it. I just think Ireland are notoriously just difficult to beat under Giovanni Trapattoni. So I've gone for Ireland, Turkey and the Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's my three teams.
I'll throw Belgium in there.
Yes.
Young team, getting better. I've been saying this for the last couple of years. One of these times it may actually come true, but I really think this might be the best campaign for Belgium coming up, because they've got a number of high-quality youngsters and they could well be a force to be contended with in pot three. Pot four, you've already discounted Scotland. So
yeah, and I was kind of torn here. I didn't know which way to turn a little bit. I went for Belarus straight off because of how impressive they've been looking in Euro 2012 qualifying. Again, it's difficult to see. Can they keep that momentum going? But the other two teams I've gone for here, Northern Ireland, who I think are kind of getting sticky again and difficult to beat, particularly in Belfast. And Armenia. I've been impressed with Armenia. They've been in Ireland's group for Euro 2012 qualifying.
Yeah.
And they've made it tough for a couple of teams. You obviously have your doubts about them on their road.
On the road.
But I think at home, they can cause some problems.
Yeah, Northern Ireland, you look at them, difficult team to beat. Their problem, of course, is winning games.
Yeah.
And that can perhaps makes them more a banana skin than perhaps a threat. Mm-hmm. Poland, I think perhaps there's a tendency to underrate Poland because we're not seeing them in Euro qualifying because they're the host nation for 2012. So into pot five, who have you got? Who have you pinpointed as the strengths in pot five?
Worth prefacing this with Group E at the moment, Moldova on 6 points.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gone for them. As a fifth seed, they seem to have a little bit of momentum. Finland, also in that same group.
Always very tricky.
Mikkel Forsell, by the way, 6 goals in 6 games in qualifying.
Who's he playing for at club level?
Luke, do you know who Forsell is with?
I think one time he was with Mönchengladbach, wasn't he? I think I'd lost track of him after that. Maybe he's back in Finland.
This is where we pause for a second. And
no, we'll keep talking. Producer Luke will find the relevant
and
details.
I've also gone for Austria.
Hanover.
Oh, okay, nice. And Hanover had a very good year this year.
Yeah, I've also gone for Austria.
Was Austria and Finland were the two I pinpointed. And I know this sounds like an oxymoron, but who are the strong teams in pot six?
Well, I have to give a shout out to Brian Kerr, who's the manager of the Faroe Islands.
Okay.
You get to pot six in qualifying and you're like, okay, is there any strong team? They've been developing, you know, he's wax lyrical about having guys who are part-time electricians and plumbers and stuff. But I've also gone for Iceland and Kazakhstan.
That's the two I went for as well.
Good
Kazakhstan,
minds.
Particularly strong at home.
Yeah.
Or strongest, certainly strongest for a pot six team. Lots of oil money there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Borat.
That's true.
Fan favourite.
Iceland, apparently. Iceland are in under 21s just now, which is going to give us a good segue. So now to the UEFA under 21 tournament, or they call it the under 21 tournament, but it's not an under 21 tournament.
No.
It's an under
false
20.
False advertising.
It is very much false advertising because it really is an under 23 tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Juan Mata, Diego Capel, just to pull two.
Michael Mancian.
No, all 23. The rules are that anybody born after January 1, 1988.
So when qualifying starts.
When qualifying starts. So you've got 23-year-old players. So when you hear under-21s, and we were just talking about this, it was always a bit of a mystery why you'd have an under-20 tournament at the world level, then a UEFA under-21 tournament. It seems so close together. The reality is they fall under different rules and regulations and how they judge the age of players and whether it's the start of qualifying or the end of the or when finals happen. And in this case, it is an they should be calling it an under-23 tournament.
Absolutely. But then you would lose out on the marketing and those images of all
youngsters.
Those players like Juan Mata, who can be adorning posters and promotional campaigns.
At the age of 23.
Yes.
You know, they're almost middle-aged, as far as players are concerned.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pretty much over the hill. Juan Mata, he's pretty much a veteran, isn't he?
23. It's an under-23 tournament. Anyway, it started off with some games so far. Belarus beat Iceland 2-0. Then we had Denmark losing 1-0 to Switzerland to a Shakira goal.
Shaqiri.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, unlike the singer, I was quite surprised about that.
I thought that was someone else that had slipped through.
And also, Shaqiri is not involved relationship with Gerard Piqué, I would like to... That's the Shaqira.
And she's Colombian as well.
Yes, yeah, so she wouldn't have qualified. But with this sort of rules of regulation, she probably would have.
There might have been another loophole there.
Yeah, she could have had a quick quiet word with an official or two.
And her hips.
Yes.
Czech Republic 2-1 over the Ukraine, and Spain and England drew 1-1 yesterday. No games today, Monday, but the 14th on Tuesday, we have Switzerland against Iceland and Denmark against Belarus, followed on Wednesday by the Czech Republic against Spain and Ukraine against England. So can we look forward to more angst amongst English journalists on their trek to wherever they're trekking to in the under-21/23s?
It was hilarious. Because if you were following Twitter updates from English journalists as the under-21 game between England and Spain went on Sunday, you would have thought that England were losing about 6-0. So embarrassed, outthought, outfought by their Spanish counterparts. It was just disgraceful from England. But then again, England, they don't know how to play the game. If you want the blueprint as to how the game should be played, look at Spain. Look at them. We are pathetic.
The matadors of soccer.
Matadors.
Oh, very good.
There you go. Juan Matadors. Anyway, in the end...
As opposed to early doors.
Okay.
Diana doors.
Diana doors. Brilliant. Reference. Answers on a postcard, please. On that, Spain absolutely destroying, hammering England.
1-0.
1-0. And England, 88th minute, Danny Welbeck equalises, and it's 1-1. So after all that, and all the complaining, moaning, whinging about how better Spain were, England actually picked up a point. And it's also worth remembering, what I loved the most was how much national pride exists in England, that after their under-21 side, or under-23 side, we probably should say, go down early on to Spain, the competition is over. Oh, we're rubbish. Oh, it's just, let's move on. No hope for these guys. And then once they get to the quarterfinals, they're going to win it. Because we'll be hearing people wax lyrical everywhere. This is the greatest generation of underage English players we've seen in a long time. England did their job to perfection. Spain controlled possession, obviously. People looking at this game going, why are Spain having so much of the ball? You're like, do you watch football? Do you watch football at all? But in the end, Spain didn't create any chances. They got to the edge of the box in the exact same way that Arsenal play, and they looked for a pass wide. There was nothing to the middle, and essentially they just missed Lionel Messi. If you're looking at a Barcelona comparison, to just
who is Argentinian, of course.
Yes, he is, and wouldn't come under the guidelines of UEFA, yes, if people are out there thinking that. But yes, England have a great under 21 team at this tournament, and they'll definitely be in with a shout of winning it. Also, a quick mention about Shaqiri, who was terrific for Switzerland. They beat Denmark by a goal to nil.
But Denmark were quite unlucky, weren't they?
Last kick of the game, they're trailing by a goal. They need obviously something from it.
Just hold it there. You can't extend this into your comments over TSN's coverage of this, because we should cover this, because this should not be allowed to pass unnoticed.
Yes, from a broadcasting perspective. So last kick of the game, Denmark chasing it. They've created so many chances, but Jan Sommer, the Switzerland keeper from Basel, making a number of great saves to keep them out. Last chance, they work at edge of the box. One of the strikers just slips it through for his partner. Lofts it, top corner. Brilliant finish, 1-1. What a game, what a finish to the game. Absolutely terrific. Linesman's got his flag up for offside. Striker, I think it's Nicky Nielsen, was absolutely raging, just totally furious with the decision.
Because you said you could see how he held his run.
You could see him. He was going to go and then makes the run and pops it home. And I'm just waiting for the replay. Let's play in the replay. Let's see how close it was. Now, TSN getting the game, obviously, from the host broadcaster who was covering it for the championships themselves. They play in a replay that lasts about 4 seconds. Which is fine. Full time comes, full time whistle blows. You're going, okay, let's go back to studio and let's look at the incident. Let's see if he was offside. Comes back to studio and they start the highlight reel from the whole game. So you start off with the early chances in the first half, and here's Switzerland taking the lead. They get to the end of the game with the most controversial moment, and they play in the same 4-second replay. So it took us in the Fox Soccer Report to be in a Reddit suite to slow down everything to the point where you can see the pass being played to actually decide whether or not it was offside.
And he wasn't.
He wasn't. He was level, and it was a bad decision. But if you watch the broadcasting of it, the incident was just made. Nothing was made of it.
Is it part of another Swiss conspiracy?
Yay, conswissery. We kind of probably took that one too much of an extreme.
But
Shaqiri. It's just
I've got him going now. He's having to hesitate on the Shaqiri bit because he's going to say Shakira.
Yes, I am actually. Shaqiri involved in this battle with Christian Eriksen, who was making his under 21 debut for Denmark in these championships.
How good did he look?
Shaqiri looked terrific. Eriksen, just a little bit slow, a bit ponderous. Yeah, I think what Eriksen's problem is he just needs a little bit more bite. He's still a
young boy.
He's very young. He's young. Very, very young.
His expectations have just been ridiculous.
Yeah,
like
he's very kind of still very, very light on his feet and needs a bit of a cutting edge. Good one. We've just been handed very modern technology here. Luke, our producer, has just handed us a piece of paper. He's just spent the last 60 seconds composing something, and it's Swiss-spiracy.
Just How rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
This is a clarification. Yes, a Swiss-spiracy, which should have been the headline in so many tabloids.
Yes.
Probably that's where my head would go. But to go back to Shaqiri, low center of gravity, kind of rotund guy, but loves playing passes and loves creating space for other people and just drops deep, wears number 10, plays for Basel, obviously. People may remember him from scoring that goal against England in the qualifier in Switzerland, which England won 3-1.
He did have an appearance in the World Cup.
Yes, he was. He was part of the World Cup squad. But looks a real handful. Very predominantly left-footed. But Lionel Messi is predominantly left-footed. Yeah. So it doesn't
so
cause him...
Couscous.
Yeah, it doesn't cause... It hasn't caused any
wee fat guy hasn't got much of a right foot.
Yeah, exactly. if Shaqiri keeps going the way he is, he will also turn into a wee fat guy. But for the moment, brilliant talent. And it looks that he'll be heading for a bigger transfer sooner rather than later.
So apart from the lack of proper replays and actually the flow of the TSN presentation in Canada.
And also
a tournament worth watching?
A tournament worth watching. Probably best if you mute Rowan Ricketts at halftime. if anyone's watching. Just better listen, just turn the volume down. It's not worth
I never watch half time.
It's just not worth listening to him going, "So basically what happened in the first half was they created chances and then they hit the post there." And you're like,
so it's rap?
Yeah, pretty much. If you put a few beats to it, it could be a number one single. It's not football analysis, Rowan, so please just think a little bit harder before opening your mouth next time, please. Thank you very much.
Okay, that brings us to an end to our podcast. You may have noticed that we didn't get to MLS.
And I've got a load of notes and everything.
You should see the notes that Owen has, but...
And I was going to express my man love for a certain Houston Dynamo player.
Well, we'll leave that up to speculation. The Twitter sphere and
Swiss
the
cyberspace.
Yes, will be.
Houston, we have a problem. Isn't it?
Well, you might do. But you can speculate on that before next week. But we will do MLS. We'll look at the All Star game coming up. All Star ballots are coming in. Everybody's got a chance to. Fans have got a chance to vote on it. So we'll have a little bit on MLS next week. We'll get to it. Our Nick Nolan MLS is just that we just couldn't consume. We couldn't find the time to get round to MLS unless we'd be going past the hour mark. So, I'm Bobby McMahon, on behalf of Owen O'Callaghan and producer Luke Crawford. Thank you for allowing us to be part of your day. Until next week, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast. For more great soccer news, highlights, and analysis, watch the Fox Soccer Report every night at 10 p.m. Eastern on Fox Soccer and Fox Sports World Canada. And be sure to check out SoccerReportExtra.com daily for previews, opinions, and reviews. Music for this podcast provided by SoundJay.com.